Hello, everyone. My name is Jasmohan Bajaj. I'm a co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Gastroenterology. And on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Millie Long, I'm delighted to have here Dr. David Rubin, who is the lead author of the recently published Ulcerative Colitis Guideline Update in the American Journal of Gastroenterology. Dr. Rubin is professor-in-chief at the University of Chicago IBD Center, and he is a foremost expert in the world of IBD, and we are delighted to have him here. Welcome, David.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for chatting with me and inviting me to discuss the new guidelines.
Well, thank you. It seems like it is a mammoth task to update any guideline, but with the major changes that have happened with IBD and especially ulcerative colitis since the last guideline, can you just give us a brief overview of what is new in these guidelines before we go to the actual question?
Yes, and you're right. It is a huge job, but it's an important one to help our colleagues know what has changed in the field and to push the field forward. The last time the American College of Gastro asked us to work on guidelines was 2019. So the last time the Practice Parameters Committee invited us to do this was 6 years ago. And in 6 years, a lot has changed in IBD and specifically in ulcerative colitis. So the new 2025 guidelines include 7 different sections discussing different aspects of management of ulcerative colitis. A new section within those 7 is one on positioning considerations because we have so many new treatment options. We actually thought it was important to weigh in on how do you make decisions, how do you choose your first therapy, and how do you think about second therapies. But we also highlighted there that we thought payers should butt out, that we didn't support step therapy and we didn't want others telling us how to choose therapies for our patients. There are 9 new therapies that have been approved by the FDA since the 2019 guidelines, and they're all covered in these new guidelines and discussed in terms of their mechanism and the strength of their evidence that led to their regulatory approval. The 2 summary tables, for those who just want to read the highlights, are tables 2 and 3, which include the evidence-based graded recommendations. There's 54 of those. And then key concept statements, which are things that are either very common sense or expert-based, but don't lend themselves nicely to the rigorous type of evidence. And there's 57 key concept statements in table 3. We also included a few other things like breaking down the different clinical phenotypes of UC, including the distal colitis with a cecal patch. And we also included for the first time PSC colitis, which is a slightly different phenotype, which may have rectal sparing. So lots for our colleagues to catch up on and to learn about and to think about so that they can take the best care of their patients who have ulcerative colitis.
Well, thank you for this nice overview and also reiterating how much has changed in such a short time. So let's jump into a few things that may be important to our readers. For the practicing gastroenterologist, when would you suspect that the patient with diarrhea, urgency, and bloody stools could actually have UC? And what set of initial tests and investigations would be needed to either prove or disprove this diagnosis?
It's a really important question, obviously, and it's more than just for our colleagues in GI, but also for internists and gynecologists and family practitioners. Anybody who has more than a couple months of GI symptoms is certainly somebody who warrants a workup. And the key clinical symptoms of ulcerative colitis are usually features of rectal bleeding. Remember that people with distal colitis may actually have a paradoxical bloating and constipation feeling that goes along with a little bit of rectal bleeding. And obviously, everyone always worries that there may be a tumor contributing to the bleeding. And especially now that we acknowledge that people are younger who are being diagnosed with colorectal cancer, that's on the list. But after that, we think about a chronic inflammatory condition like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's. And the important thing that we want to emphasize and we include in the guidelines is that your first endoscopic exam, when you're trying to make the diagnosis, should not only include biopsies of the inflamed areas where you will expect and need to show chronicity in order to consider it to be ulcerative colitis, but remember to biopsy the endoscopically normal areas as well, so that you can characterize the extent of disease and understand what things are before you've started therapy. Once you start therapy, it can be a bit confusing and can look more patchy. And that's part of the consideration. Obviously, you also want to exclude infections. Remember that patients who have COVID may have GI symptoms related to that infection, but all of those types of considerations would not have chronicity, would not have the chronic changes you would expect. And just as a separate comment, I'll just say that despite ongoing work, we haven't seen that the COVID pandemic led to more IBD. That doesn't seem to be related.
Thank you. And the biopsy changes that you're talking about are mostly chronicity, including bifid glands and things that would go away from, you know, the acute infections that people might have with dysentery?
Yeah. So what I say to patients is that, you know, we're looking for microscopic scarring, which can be in the form of architectural distortion. And to your point, absolutely, the crypts are branched or distorted in other ways with or without acute inflammation. My senior GI pathologist here, who I love, John Hart, has said to me that he believes that even a few weeks of active inflammation in somebody who has IBD is enough to give you some chronic changes. And that means that by the time we investigate and we've ruled out infection, we will find chronic changes. And of course, we always have the adage that time is on our side. For a patient in whom you're not sure, it doesn't quite make sense, of course, you follow up and you repeat the exam and you repeat the biopsies if necessary.
Thank you. So the guideline, as you pointed out correctly, goes through a lot of scoring systems for ulcerative colitis, including the anatomical one that you just talked about. What are the best ways to apply these systems, and how should they guide therapy decisions or define success?
That's a really important question. I want to highlight that in the 2019 guidelines, we introduced the proposed ACG disease activity index for ulcerative colitis. And in the 2025 guidelines, we've updated that. And this is a modified version of the old Truelove and Witz criteria. And what we've changed about these to bring them up to speed and relevant to your question is that it includes the category of remission. So believe it or not, Truelove and Witz didn't include remission. It just included mild, moderate, and severe. And it also includes measures of mucosal inflammation. And in reference to the indices and the ways to score this, as a practicing clinician, the things you want to know to address a patient who has ulcerative colitis are stool frequency, rectal bleeding, and we added and included, and we all agree now, that bowel urgency is the other major symptom. And so a patient who has those active symptoms, obviously we want response to therapy to restore a normal stool frequency, to eliminate rectal bleeding, and to eliminate bowel urgency or rectal urgency. The other part of this then is, in addition to symptom improvement, we want objective measures. And the STRIDE consensus in the IBD space suggests that endoscopic improvement might be satisfactory. We all know that endoscopic remission, meaning a normal-looking bowel, is even better. What is not yet embraced in the guidelines but is being actively studied is whether we should treat to histologic control. So in your clinical practice, you don't necessarily need to calculate a Mayo score or know what the modified Mayo score is, or even know necessarily what the UCEIS endoscopic score is. What you do need to know is stool frequency, rectal bleeding, urgency, and endoscopic improvement. And of course, if you are using it and you have it a benchmarked biomarker, you can rely on calprotectin, and sometimes CRP is another way to know what's going on. So for the clinician, not about calculating a score so much as knowing those main features of confirming someone's feeling better and that the disease process is under.
It's really nice that you were able to synthesize both the patient outcomes as well as clinicians' reported outcomes as well as endoscopic and fecal biomarkers that we can actually put into practice and also go as deep as possible if you want to do clinical trials as well.
Yeah, and to that point again, you know, what I really love about the American College of Gastro and I'm proud about in our guidelines is we think about our colleagues and the clinical utility of these guidelines. And we embraced CalPro in 2019, we expand upon it in 2025, and we want people to understand that this should be covered by payers. This is considered standard of practice, and using a calprotectin, especially for colitis, is a highly sensitive, reproducible, and reliable test.
Thank you. There's also this phenotype of left-sided mild to moderate UC, where a lot of the therapies are either topical or enema-based. When would you actually suggest moving on from enema or topical therapies to systemic medications in this group? And then what are the first-line therapies for pancolitis in a similar mild to moderate patients? And of course, where the topical or enema-related therapies would not work.
And so I'll start with the rationale for using topical or rectal-based therapies in those patients. When you talk about mild to moderate colitis, for the most part, we only have one therapy that's been FDA approved and is used, and that's mesalamine. And we talk about using either oral or rectal or both. Of course, it's not new to understand that both works better than either one alone, but that in general, when you have distal colitis, treating topically with 5-ASA is much more effective than trying to get oral medicine to make its way down to the distal colon, especially because the normal colon proximally becomes dilated and has a relative lack of motility into that distal area. So it makes sense. The difference, though, is that it's not necessarily a maintenance strategy that a patient would like to be able to function otherwise to use a nocturnal enema indefinitely as their maintenance. So what we discuss is that, of course, this is reasonable to induce remission and to control the disease. We do acknowledge there's evidence for enema therapy as a maintenance. But when a patient has healing and improvement in their distal colitis, transitioning to oral-based therapy for maintenance makes complete sense. The other thing I want to emphasize is that when somebody isn't responding to optimized oral or rectal 5-ASA, even if their symptoms are relatively mild, we should acknowledge that when they need to go beyond 5-ASA, they're now in the category of moderate. And that opens up the door for all the new therapies we have that are approved for moderately to severely active ulcerative colitis. And a main message in these guidelines as well is that the extent of colitis should not dictate which therapy you use. It should be about the response to treatment and achieving your goals of remission. And therefore, using a systemic therapy after a topical one doesn't work is absolutely appropriate, whether that's your S1P receptor modulator or any of our different monoclonal antibody and biological therapies. So people should understand that and not be shy. One of the challenges we face in IBD generally, both Crohn's and UC, is under-treatment. And remember, we have specific goals to help us move through therapies to get our patients the quality of life that they deserve.
So therefore, with the mild to moderate pancolitis patients, what would be the first-line therapies that you would start?
So for mild to moderate disease, for that means usually, you know, 3 to 6 stools a day, some rectal bleeding, maybe some urgency, hand colitis, I would still start with oral 5-ASA with a suppository or an enema combined. There's a good prospective randomized study to show that that's better than using just oral. And certainly with pancolitis, it's obviously better than just rectal therapy. After the patient achieves symptom control and endoscopic improvement or a calpro that's significantly improved, and for me that means 50% better than baseline, ideally less than 200 or less than 150, then you can withdraw the rectal therapy and focus on only oral maintenance there. If that strategy hasn't worked, or if they don't stay in remission with your oral 5-ASA despite your efforts, then you can discuss moving on to the next level of therapy.
The guideline goes into great detail about the more advanced patients, the people who present in moderate to severely active UC, and they go into several details about induction and maintenance. And you had said that, you know, induction and maintenance of remission are very important but very different approaches. So what are the overarching principles for therapeutic approaches that differentiate the two stages of UC in this population?
I love this question. Thank you for asking it. I think it's really important that we all understand that IBD is managed in phases. And the first phase is induction of remission. And the second phase is maintenance of remission. And I want to emphasize this because one of the mistakes we can make is transitioning to a maintenance management strategy before successful induction. Ideally, induction is about improving symptoms rapidly, gaining control of the active disease process, or what we would call disease modification. And then maintenance is about prevention of relapse. maintenance is not supposed to be about treating active disease chronically. So we really emphasize the point of you want to induce remission successfully before you move on to maintenance. Now, in the real world, that may mean that somebody achieves this rapidly in the first 4 to 6 to 8 weeks. It may mean that they're a little slower and it takes 12 to 16 weeks before they actually get there, but it's an important concept to keep in mind. And one of the main reasons people lose response in maintenance and have a relapse is because they actually haven't achieved true stable induction successfully. But I think that's important. It's how I communicate to patients as well. And the concept of communicating to a patient that maintenance is about prevention and not about treating an active disease chronically is a very important message, because it's a lot easier for someone to understand and perhaps embrace that they're preventing the disease from coming back, as opposed to thinking that this just reminds them they have disease. But also, it also emphasizes that if they are in stable remission and they skip a dose of their maintenance therapy, they're probably going to stay in remission for at least the next period of time. When they skip more than one dose, or if they develop subtherapeutic levels of their drug, is when they're going to break through over time. So it's an important message so people all are on the same page.
So building upon this, what do the guidelines recommend as an optimal approach to achieving UC remission and, of course, maintaining that? You don't have to go into details because I know there's a bewildering array of drugs.
Yeah, that's okay. But the general principles are the same. So I think it's a really important question you're asking. One of the messages we have is don't undertreat. So if you have a patient in front of you who has clear, moderately to severely active disease, don't treat them for mild. As much as we all love the idea of using a mesalamine-based therapy, if somebody is presenting to you with extensive colitis and more active ulcerations on their scope, maybe their serum albumin is a little bit low or it's borderline on the low end, and they are young and they're a bit anemic, why would you try to just control all that with mesalamine when we have other options we know work? So the first message is, don't undertreat. The second message in the modern world is we don't always need corticosteroids either. If you look at all the phase 3 trials of all the new treatments available for ulcerative colitis, you can appreciate that a significant percentage of patients in all these trials were not on steroids on entry. So if we know we're going to give somebody an effective therapy out of the gate, then we should also recognize that we might be able to avoid the steroids altogether. But the point here is don't undertreat and don't drag this along too long while the patient is suffering. The other message for choosing therapy and making sure you induce success is remember that 30 to 40% of people with inflammatory bowel disease will have extraintestinal manifestations. So if a patient in front of you presents with their active colitis, you should be asking and assessing for joint pain, back pain, skin inflammation, a history of skin inflammation, and you should be thinking ahead about your treatment options that will address multiple problems. And fortunately, without getting into all the details, many of our new classes of therapies do address extraintestinal problems because they're approved for multiple different indications. So this helps you choose your therapy to achieve the appropriate control without dragging someone along. One of the main messages I have in 2025 and going into 2026 is if you have somebody with moderately to severely active IBD, treat them with a therapy shown to be safe and effective for moderately to severely active IBD.
So it's so important to classify patients and stage them accurately and continue to do so with the treatments. Yes. So I know the first line therapies for majority of the non-ASA products is anti-TNF. And there is a growing population of patients who lose their response to that. What do the guidelines suggest for our clinicians to do in that stage, how to manage them using antibodies, tables, et cetera? What would be your recommendations?
Let me start by saying that we do have multiple options as a first-line advanced therapy after 5-ASA, including the S1P receptor modulators. And our newer therapies all enable us to consider positioning them early, with the exception of JAK inhibitors. In the United States, JAKs have to be positioned after anti-TNF, or at least that's the label. So I want to highlight that you can use anything, but you're right. Even in 2025, with all of our new options, we still acknowledge that infliximab is our strongest therapy among the anti-TNFs and a very good option. And it's also the one that's been studied the most for the acute severe colitis patient in the hospital. And we also have learned the most about serum concentrations and therapeutic drug monitoring. In the guidelines, we specifically say that assessment of drug levels in a patient who is losing response is supported by good evidence so that you can assess whether there's room for dose optimization or whether you need to move on to a different treatment due to immunogenicity or mechanistic escape. We also go on to say that there is insufficient evidence, and we would actually go a step further and say that we don't recommend that you check drug levels in patients who are on other biological therapies. So the IL-23 inhibitors and vedolizumab, the anti-integrin drug, we don't suggest that, and there's an inadequate amount of evidence to support that it would be helpful. So the general message for a clinician, a practicing gastroenterologist, is of course to be proactive in assessing disease activity and to be thoughtful about using your drugs. And if you're using infliximab and arguably, I think, adalimumab, certainly understanding how to interpret serum concentrations is reasonable so you can make decisions and manage those people appropriate. I happen to use proactive drug monitoring in my own practice in high-risk patients like the obese patient or the patient with extensive and active disease by checking a drug level before I get to my third loading dose and make adjustments. That's a bit more advanced for most who are listening to our podcast, but I will say that it's not supported otherwise in the other drugs. And the most important thing is to obviously assess the objective measures of disease control and then to make decisions about how to move on to other classes of therapy.
Thank you. And last but not the least, a few questions about acute severe ulcerative colitis, which we all want to avoid, but unfortunately that is, as some patients do present in that. The guidelines do a great job going through step-by-step analysis, and actually there's a beautiful flowchart as well for the readers to look at. So at what stage, after excluding C. difficile and CMV and other causes of diarrhea, when would you want a surgeon involved? And what medications should we be starting after we've excluded all of these concomitant or basically other infections that could masquerade as ASUC?
Let me start by saying that, as I think many of our colleagues will agree, the number of people getting admitted for inflammatory bowel disease complications now is less than it has been over the years. And that's in part due to the availability of effective therapies that we use as outpatients. So we describe the patient with acute severe colitis. We also describe the patient who has medically resistant colitis who needs inpatient management. And that's all distinct from the patient with fulminant colitis, who has what I describe as a train run off the tracks, where the disease is just progressing and you can't gain control. The answer to your first question is, it's recommended that a colorectal surgeon or an appropriate experienced surgeon be involved at the time of admission, not 3 days later when the patient's getting worse or not responding to therapy. I think that's an important piece to this. The second message about choice of therapy, the strongest evidence still exists for infliximab and the old drug cyclosporin as a small molecule that has some benefit. But recognizing that most of our colleagues don't use cyclosporin, I do want to say that we do comment that the JAK inhibitors, both hofacitinib and upadacitinib, have data to support their utility in the inpatient severe colitis. But the studies that have been available use off-label dosing and concomitant corticosteroids, and we concluded at the time of these guidelines that it was insufficient for us to recommend the use of a JAK inhibitor in a patient with acute severe colitis. And so as much as that's tempting and as much as we're interested in it, we're not quite there yet. So the next question, of course, is do you use accelerated dosing of infliximab for the severe colitis patient? And I'll just tell everyone that there's a prospective study, a randomized study, looking at empiric dose escalation of infliximab in a hospital setting. And it didn't show superiority over the 5 mg/kg dosing. And so we all might have the inclination to give 10 mg/kg and to give a second dose 3 days later. But the reality is that the evidence doesn't support that. And so the last point I'll make is if the patient truly is not improving in some obvious way, surgery is still needed. It's still needed in about 10% of our patients, and we need to acknowledge that. And that's why we want to work hand in hand with our surgeons to do all this. I guess the last thing I'll mention is that there's, and I think many know this, there's emerging interest and evidence for intestinal ultrasound is another way to assess. And we now know that you can use an intestinal ultrasound at the bedside and in 24 to 48 hours actually know if somebody's responding to their treatment because the bowel wall thickness improves significantly. So we have some new tools that I think will influence the next iteration of these guidelines.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Rubin, and thank you to all the co-authors who put so much time and effort into the ACG ulcerative colitis update, which is now published in the Red Journal. Off note, there are two other guidelines on IBD. It's been a blockbuster 2 months for IBD. So we also have the Crohn's disease guideline update, and we also have the preventative care in IBD guidelines. And I would urge our readers to read all three to get a composite look into IBD. And we thank Dr. Rubin on behalf of all our listeners, and thank you for being here.
Well, let me thank my co-authors properly. Ashwin Ananthakrishnan from MGH, Corey Siegel from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, and both Ed Barnes and Millie Long from UNC. Obviously a team approach and a huge effort, and I'm very grateful to them. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.